Hello, I'm Serena Ashman, and I'm a female engineer. Because I'm in a predominantly male environment, oftentimes my voice is not heard. For example, I was in a team meeting a couple weeks ago, and I noticed that one of the solutions that had been proposed had a long-term issue. When I pointed that out, one of my coworkers said, "Hey, princess, this is the real world, and we're only concerned with real issues." Everyone in the room laughed, and I stayed silent. What I should have said was, a woman's perspective is key. In the 1950s, if it hadn't been for one female doctor on the US FDA Board of Approval, the miracle drug to prevent morning sickness in pregnancies would have been introduced to the US market. This drug had been approved in the UK, Canada, and other European countries. Because Dr. Frances Kelsey wanted more information about the long-term effects of the drug, they waited. While they are waiting for this information, women in the UK began delivering their babies. These babies were born with a major birth defect where they are missing limbs. Because of one female doctor, we avoided this drug on the US market. I told my manager what had happened in that meeting, and he said, "Well, you are a girl in engineering. This is something you've got to get used to." I thought, "No, it's not," and put in my 2 weeks. The 2 weeks flew by, and on the last day, one of my team members approached me and said, "Hey, Serena, that issue that you brought up was an issue, and we found it upon testing. Would you please stay a couple more days and help us solve it?" I said, "No, it's this princess's last day, and I'm gonna go home." Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Grace Osuski, and the title of my speech is "There Is Only Us." Angela Garcia spent her entire life in a small rural town in southeastern Utah. The town was a political bubble. Everything bad happening in the rest of the country never arrived at their front door. That is, until ICE carried out a raid. ICE arrested and detained her uncle. He was taken right in front of her. And when Angela told me over the phone, it broke my heart because I had never heard her so afraid and so scared. But Angela's story is all too familiar. Mother Jones, on July 3rd, 2018, reports that more than 160 children were affected by a single parental raid carried out in Tennessee. The Guardian, on September 25th, 2018, reports that in one of the single largest raids to date, ICE arrested 143 individuals in Salem, Ohio, merely suspected of being in the country illegally from Guatemala. Families continue to live in fear of deportation or separation because of the aggressive extension of the state's reach in the ICE era and anti-immigration fervor stirred up by the president. It's high time those of us who have the ability to speak out do so, because not a day goes by where there isn't a story about a motherless child or a childless mother, both of whom were ripped from each other's arms. In order to combat organizations like ICE, we have to work together and use a collective voice. Throughout history, groups have worked together to create effective change. Citizens have an obligation to speak out against abusive institutions. And speaking out is a necessity, especially against organizations like ICE. In times like these, there is no them, there is no other, there is only us.
Five foot 10, 165 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes, medium build. A B student through high school graduating in the 50th percentile. I've never been fired from a job. Turns out I've also never been promoted. Before you stands vanilla ice cream. Someone who is average in just about every way from appearance to experience. And you know what? I was actually okay with that until something changed everything. I can still remember sitting in that hospital room 3 years ago, holding her in my arms for the very first time. Her small, delicate fingers wrapped around mine tightly as if to give her approval of me. And today I'll find her watching out the window waiting for me to get home from school. When I walk in, she's there with her arms open, ready for daddy's hug. But sometimes I have to put her in timeout. And she'll look up at me with those big blue tear-filled eyes and whisper, "Sorry, daddy," cutting me to the core every time. But tickle fights are the best, especially when I let her win. She'll let out the most adorable, but slightly evil, laugh of prevail. You see, I used to think I was average. But Kennedy changed that, because no one else in the entire world is Kennedy's dad. And that makes me special. Whether it's a father or a mother, a best friend or crazy uncle, a devoted spouse or a child, it's these relationships that make us unique and change something from average to invaluable. So while to most I may be vanilla ice cream, it turns out that my Kennedy is the joy-filled sprinkles that make me a not-so-average daddy.
My name is Alexis Cortez, and the title of my speech is "The Road Less Traveled By." For premature babies, sometimes the difference between surviving and dying is as simple as touch. Studies show that babies that had consistent touch and loving contact not only had increased chances of surviving, but of thriving, and had results that were measurable even 10 years later. Do you remember the last time that someone hugged you? What about when they gave you that take your whole body and squeeze so tight it catches your breath, two-arm kind of hug? Do you remember the last time that someone hugged you like that? What about the last time someone reached out to you, maybe with an actual phone call, just to say that they missed you, to check in or to thank you for something you once did for them? Has it been a while? Has anyone just asked in general what's going on in your life and then actually listened? A recent study shows that loneliness is more deadly than obesity, meaning that over 76,000 people a year die because they're lonely. That means if there were just 30 people in this room, the person sitting at the end of your row might be dead this year because of loneliness. Add to that loneliness bullying. Add to that loneliness bigotry, racism, and religious intolerance. Utah has some of the highest suicide rates in the country for teenagers, women, and members of the LGBTQ+ community. There are grandparents who die alone after not being contacted or visited in months. I think we need a little more kindness, genuine connection, touch. If premature babies who just exist need touch in order to stay alive, then how much more do we, as stressed out, hardworking, news-watching adults, not need a hug every once in a while? If you're listening to my questions earlier and realize that it's been a while since you've experienced any of those things, I ask this. When was the last time that you did one of those things for someone else? Robert Frost wrote a little-known poem about two roads in a yellow wood, and he spoke of one less traveled by. Today, I believe that kindness and genuine connection is that road. Many people would say that we need a lot more than that to change the world, but I believe if we choose to take that road less traveled by, it will, as Mr. Frost said, make all the difference. Thank you.
My name is Alyssa Stringham, and the title of my speech is "Lost and Found." Everything that I'm wearing, with the exception of my shoes, I made myself. The majority of it is hand-knitted, including my bra, which is mostly impractical, but I chose to make it. I get a lot of comments while I'm knitting, things like, "I learned to do that once, but not like that," or, "Wow, you are so talented." But the most common comment that I get is, "Knitting, that is a lost art." I read about another lost art earlier this year. The New Yorker published the headline, "A Lost Story by Sylvia Plath Contains the Seeds of the Writer She Would Become." The Indiana University Lilly Library noticed and came out on Twitter saying, "We're not sure how we feel about this story being described as lost because it's in our collections and accessible to anyone who wants to come see it." You know, when materials are in libraries and archives, they're actually the opposite of lost, end quote. There seems to be a trend these days where we mourn for things before they're really dead. Some of it can be seen in those "millennials are killing blank" articles, but a lot of it seems to be coming from this nostalgia society that we're cultivating. It's a society that is obsessed and haunted by the idea that what we have now can never be as good as what we've had before. We're neglecting the progress we've made and keep reviving and rebooting the prototypes. There are tens of thousands of results returned when you search how to knit on YouTube. There are thriving online communities of fiber artists who are developing new techniques and premiering new designs daily. Perhaps from the outside, they're speaking in like pre-Tower of Babel words, they're Atlantean groups, but I felt welcomed when I found them. We shouldn't declare something lost before we've arrived at the scene or even learn to take a pulse. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ashton, and I'm terrified to be up here right now, but I'm trying to be more vulnerable. To me, vulnerability is about showing up as your true self and taking an opportunity even when you know it might end in failure, rejection, or being hurt. I don't think I'm alone in this. I think a lot of people struggle with vulnerability, which is unfortunate because I think a lot of people also know that vulnerability is the only path to our deepest connections and our greatest happiness. I was listening to an interview with Dr. Brené Brown, who studies vulnerability, and she brought up a Theodore Roosevelt quote, which you all should look up after this. It's a great quote. But the basic idea of the quote is that the credit doesn't go to the critic who says that the doer of deeds could have done better, but it goes to the person who's actually in the arena, who's fighting the good fight, who's trying and failing and stumbling, but getting back up to try again. After I registered for this event, I tried really hard to talk myself out of it because this is the exact sort of thing I would never do. But then I thought, what if someone could benefit from hearing this? What if someone needs a nudge, a reminder to open themselves up to vulnerability and enter the arena, to give someone a call and tell them that they miss them or that they love them or that they're sorry, to try a new hobby, or to let themselves be seen for who they truly are. I don't know what that looks like for you. I'm still learning what that looks like for me, but that's why I'm here today. So to the organizers of this event, thank you for giving me an opportunity to enter the arena.
I am Anthony Scoma, and this is The Human Brain, a Mixed Bag. I have studied journalism and political science for the last 4 years here at the U. And if getting a higher education has taught me anything, it is that the human brain is limited. Of course, the human brain is a fantastic thing, which is why this speech is not about the limitations of the human brain, but about how we must overcome them. Of course, the human brain has evolved to allow us to learn from the past, adapt in the present, and plan for the future. Across human history, we have honed these skills through science, art, language, and mathematics. In spite of these advancements, I've identified three areas where the human brain limits us in understanding the problems that we face: numbers, space, and time. Numbers, an ingenious invention of humanity, but one that has severely distorted our perceptions. Millions and billions and trillions all sound very similar, but they are orders of magnitude apart. This reality becomes more obvious when you convert them to time. A million seconds, 11 and a half days. A billion seconds, 32 years, and a trillion seconds, 31,710 years. You can see why all these numbers becoming synonymous with a lot could be a problem of comprehension. Space and time, on the other hand, are not limited by our language, but by our human bodies. These concepts are fluid and change over the course of our lives. An hour is a very different thing to a 2-year-old versus a 60-year-old. Space is similarly subjective. Someone who's driven from coast to coast will have a much more nuanced understanding of the size of this country than someone who's flown the same trip. So what do the vastness of space, the fluidity of time, and the incomprehensibility of numbers have to do with us and our problems? Quite a lot, as it turns out. In 2017, humanity collectively released 45 billion, billion with a B, tons of carbon dioxide into the Earth's atmosphere, following a 50-year trend. This number is fundamental to the crisis of climate change, which makes itself known through extreme weather events, weakened ecosystems, and animal extinction. In a world increasingly interconnected across space and time through technology, the symptoms of this existential threat are harder to ignore. The time for inaction and ignorance is past. This fight cannot be delayed or outrun. It must be faced with ingenuity, boldness, and compassion. Fortunately for all of us, that is what the human brain is best at. Thank you.
Hello.
My name is Michelle, and my speech is titled Can't. Can't. Such a small but powerful word. When I was 19, I got pregnant with our oldest son, and people said, "You can't possibly continue with school. Your life is over." I've been told I can't my whole life, whether it be because the color of my skin, my gender, or simply just to make other people feel better. That moment was the moment that I decided to stop listening to everybody tell me that I can't and started telling myself that I can. I'm currently halfway through my master's degree program. I'm one of 13 women, one of only two moms, and the only Black student in my cohort. I sometimes wonder if it's because these other minority groups are told we can't. Last month, there was a conference in town. It was about customer experience, and I really wanted to go. The keynote speaker, President Barack Obama. Suddenly, it wasn't other people telling me that I can't. It was myself. I said, I can't go. I can't afford that ticket. I have kids. I quickly realized my can't mentality and decided, how can I get there? I started making homemade lasagnas to raise money. The CEO of the conference found out, not only gifted me a ticket, but a personal meet and greet with President Barack Obama. That wasn't my favorite part of the experience. It was when I got home and my boys ran up to me and said, Mom, now you can be president. They said, can. I'm here to tell you that you can. Use can't as motivation rather than discouragement. So the next time someone tells you that you can't, just look them in their face, smile, and say, watch me.
My name is Sahar Kanishka. Can I touch your hair? Ever since I was a child, I've been flooded with questions about my hair. At the time, I didn't think much of it, but I began to wonder, why did people always ask to touch my hair? I mean, if I asked them, that would be kind of weird. As time went on, I became more curious with this question, and I finally found an answer: microaggressions. Simple acts that seem innocent, but have very racist undertones. Like asking someone, but where are you actually from? Like originally, or following a person of color around in a store to make sure they aren't stealing anything. The problem with subtle racism is that it is being taught at a very young age. It can be seen in movies, TV shows, social media, and even Barbies. Subtle racism is unconsciously embedded in the way people think. In the Clark doll test, children were asked to choose between a white and a black doll, and all the children chose the white doll. They said it was because it was prettier and cleaner. This type of ideology has already been instilled in the minds of children, and it continues to grow with them as they do. A major example of subtle racism today is the shootings of innocent, unarmed people of color. Michael Brown was shot 6 times, even though he had his hands up. Trayvon Martin had his hand in his pocket and his hoodie up, and he was killed because of that. He was killed because he was black. He was seen as a threat because of the color of his skin, yet people continue to try and justify the actions of the murderers by saying, but it looked like he had a gun, but he looked threatening. What if he wasn't black? Would he still be threatening then? These excuses are blatant representation of subtle racism that people of color endure every day. We need to raise our children to embrace differences instead of being fearful of them, because people aren't born knowing how to hate. They learn it. And if they can learn how to hate, they can learn how to love. Thank you.
Transgender folks are receiving more media attention than ever. We're seeing them starring on the small screen, serving in our military, and even holding public office. But although acceptance is growing, we still have a lot of work to do. Trans folks are more likely to experience discrimination, harassment, and violence than their peers. And one of the most notorious pieces of legislation that legitimizes this prejudice are bathroom bills, laws that bar trans folks from using the restroom of their choice. Now, proponents of bathroom bills claim they're protecting people, essentially stopping would-be predators from slipping into a restroom because by claiming they're women. Now, not only is this convoluted, but there is no evidence to support it. Take Massachusetts, which recently passed an anti-discrimination law protecting trans folks. In the years since the bill's passing, the state has seen no increase in bathroom-related crimes because, and this is important, the law didn't legalize harassment. In fact, it was created to minimize it. And yet, the White House has rescinded the right of trans students to use the restroom of their choice. Even Education Secretary Betsy DeVos agrees that this decision violates schools' moral obligation to protect some of their most vulnerable because, again, policy legitimizes prejudice. When the law doesn't respect trans folks, why expect anyone else to? Over 80% of trans folks have reported being harassed in schools, and this frequently turns violent. Rates of self-harm are staggeringly high, and over 40% of trans youth have reported at least one suicide attempt. Now, I hope that these numbers make everyone here just as angry as they make me. Clearly, trans students need love and support, not rejection, coming from the very institutions that are supposed to keep them safe. Look, I'm not asking for a lot. I'm not asking for you to come out to Pride or to protest, although that would be great. For now, I'm just asking for your support, because these laws are legitimizing hate and fear against some of our most vulnerable, when in reality, they just need love. They need allies. All I ask is that you support trans folks in the workplace, in schools, and yeah, even the restroom. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I am Vaibhav Pandey, and my speech is titled An Innocent Question. So I was 12 when a friend told me how kids are born. I vividly recall my first reaction. My father would never do this to my mom. He's a good person. My entire world changed. I couldn't believe that this happened. I started looking at all adults with a feeling of absolute amazement. Have all adults conspired to keep this big secret away from small kids like me? It bothered me deeply if it was true. Was it? It couldn't be. Sounds like it needs a lot of practice. Where would the adults practice this? Do they have like a secret school to teach that? Okay, I'll ask my father, I decided. So that night, we were watching the Discovery Channel, a show about whales, where the presenter said, how do whales reproduce? My father instantly changed the channel, and before I knew it, we were watching the Cartoon Network. The next day in school, though, I had my Eureka moment. My father had recently installed the Encyclopedia Britannica on our new computer. In the midst of the class, I blurted, aha, I will look up the word sex on Britannica tonight. The look that my teacher gave me is something that I still remember. The very next day, my parents were summoned to school and my gymnasium and library services were taken away. The school prefect badge, which I so loved and adored and I was proud of, was also confiscated. I was filled with extreme shame. For months, I couldn't look my parents in the eye and shivered quietly every time a classmate asked me why I was punished. I wonder, though, what would have happened? What would have happened if my father that night or my teacher the next day had said, wow, you seem to have an interesting question. Here is a book. It talks about human anatomy and something called puberty. Now is the right time to read it. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jesse Raby, and I want to encourage all of you to save the environment by saving your wallet. The environment is in crisis. We have plastic in our waterways and smog in the air and climate change just on the horizon. Many proposed solutions may be good for the environment, but oftentimes they are too expensive for most people to afford. For many, protecting the environment may just seem too overwhelming or financially out of reach, especially when life is already as stressful as it is. But saving the environment may just be the key to solving one of life's biggest stressors, financial insecurity. Because oftentimes, when you make the world a greener place, you can make your wallet a greener place too. I can't afford solar panels, let alone do I have a house to put them on, but I can decrease my utility bill and just turn off the lights when I'm gone. I can't afford a sustainably made Patagonia jacket, but I can buy used, or better yet, enjoy what I already have and buy nothing at all. I can't afford an electric car, but I can ride the train to school and leave my gas-guzzling car at home. Saving the environment does not need to be expensive. If each one of us change a few of our habits each day, not only could we decrease the excessive machine of overconsumption, but we could solve financial insecurity all in one. The world doesn't need costly environmental absolutism. The world needs 7 billion people doing their part each day to make this world a greener place for everyone. And at the same time, saving everyone a little bit of money too. Thank you.
Perfect, thank you. My name is Damon Noh, and my speech is titled The Boy Who Crossed the Sea. When I was a kid, my dad used to tell me the story of the boy who crossed the sea. The boy was just 12 years old when his mom asked him to go on a very important mission, to escape the country and to find a new home for his family. The boy packed his bag, hopped on a bus, headed for the coast, and climbed into a small fishing boat. And when night fell, they left for open waters. For 5 days, the boy saw nothing but water all around him. He was hungry and thirsty, but he never forgot his mission. Just as a storm was on the horizon, an oil tanker rescued him, took him back to Singapore, where he was put into an orphanage at a refugee camp. He missed his friends and his family, but he never forgot his mission. 5 months later, he was on his way to America, a place he had only seen in the movies, then put into a foster home, where he just wished that people would understand his language and didn't make fun of him, but he never forgot his mission. He would go on to finish school, meet the love of his life, and graduate from college with 2 degrees. And still, he didn't forget his mission. He got a job in social work, studied immigration policy in his free time, and after nearly 30 years, he was able to sponsor his entire family over to America and finally complete his mission. The boy taught me to laugh in the face of impossible, whether it be getting that 3.0 and turning it into a 4.0, or facing the same bullies that he did. The ones that didn't like the way I looked, or made fun of the food, the way that my food smelled in the middle school cafeteria. And in the same way the boy never forgot his mission, I'll never forget the way that my dad used to end the story. And do you know what that boy is doing now, he would always ask? He's telling me his story right now, I would always answer. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Ruel. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater next to the white chickens. This poem by William Carlos Williams is studied in classrooms across the nation in a search for its significance. And I personally believe that this poem is absolute bullshit. I hate it. It means nothing to me personally. Honestly, I think it sucks. But there is an endless supply of poetry. And if I never want to read a poem about a wheelbarrow ever again, I don't have to. And the same is true for all art. We don't have to wallow on the pieces that we hate, but instead find the ones that make us happy. When you walk through a museum, you don't have to look at every painting. Just the one that reminds you of that day at the lake with your sister and your cousin where you couldn't stop giggling. The one where the longer you look at it, the deeper you inhale and your shoulders relax and you feel something. When I listen to music, I will skip song after song until I find one that reminds me of my dear friend because he's living so very far away right now, but the right song can make it feel like he's close at hand. To experience art and to experience it well is to feel understood by the creators in ways we didn't even know we could be understood in before, to be connected to other people who also love that art. And look, maybe you hate my speech right now. Don't worry, it's almost over. But you're gonna hear a lot more today. You've already heard a lot. And I genuinely hope you hear one that makes you feel understood by the speaker, a story you can connect to other people who also enjoyed it. I implore you to seek out these artistic experiences, to be understood and connected to others. What we all desire, what we all deserve is this. And now more than ever, I think so much depends upon it. Thank you.
And why should we believe Engineering Barbie? The room erupted in laughter. Perhaps with my light pink shirt, nude high heels, and fuchsia calculator, I resembled the iconic plastic doll. I smiled. To me, Barbie was a doctor and a dancer, an athlete and an astronaut, a politician and a princess, but not an insult. Mattel recently announced a new line of science, exploration, and research Barbies. This decision was met with strong public criticism, backed by sensationalized research claiming that Barbie negatively impacts girls' career aspirations and is responsible for body dysmorphia in women. However, these studies lack scientific merit, instead relying on unrepresentative sample sizes to support their claims. Instead, what this unwarranted criticism highlights is a pervasive bias in our society. Simply put, Barbie's not taken seriously because of how she appears. Dr. Stephanie Johnson, an expert in the beauty is beastly effect, says that interviewers struggle to hear what women say during interviews, instead focusing on if the candidate appears too feminine for the role. And this bias isn't isolated to potential employers alone. A full-stack engineer, Isis Wenger, experienced intense internet backlash when her image was used to recruit software engineers as she did not look like an engineer. In a society where female engineers are judged based on their appearance instead of their achievements, perhaps Barbie is the best toy to prepare girls for a career in STEM. Through my colleagues' laughs, I responded, "I love Barbie." The entire room fell silent. When I was a kid, I made her different parachutes and tested which one worked the best. I paused, uncapping my maroon dry erase marker. If you're unsure of my conclusion, let's walk through the calculations more explicitly.
One of the few requirements a student must complete in order to drop out of high school is to have all of their current teachers sign a release form. So there I was, a 15-year-old, walking the halls of the education system that had failed me, just like it fails over 1 million students per year. As I approached my history teacher, seeking her permission to drop out, she looked me in the eyes and told me it would be the biggest mistake that I would ever make. But rather than fight for me, fight for my education, she signed the form, as did all 7 of my teachers. Many will say I failed, but the system failed me. So in the 14 years since that day, I've thought a lot about why the system failed me. In the 14 years since that day, I've completed my GED, bachelor's degree, professional certificates, and I'm currently pursuing my MBA, but most aren't so lucky. According to the American Council on Education, only 12% of dropouts will complete a college degree within 10 years of dropping out, far below the completion rate of high school graduates. 1.2 million students will drop out of high school this year. So how do we keep our students in the classroom? First, we need to decrease our class sizes. In a recent survey, 50% of dropouts blamed boredom for why they dropped out of school. Boredom can take many shapes: failing, extended absences, or not being challenged academically. I know I was bored. Starving to be academically challenged, my overworked and underpaid teachers were unable to give me the attention I needed to succeed. Second, it's time we pay our teachers more. We shouldn't have to rely on our teachers feeling good about their profession to have a successful career. We should strive to offer a generous compensation package that allows our teachers to thrive financially. Gone should be the days when our teachers are driving Uber on the weekend to pay their mortgages. According to the system, I was a failure. According to the system, 1.2 million kids will fail this year. Do you think we are failures?
My name is Emma Shekina. 5 years ago, I came to the United States just like this. I was holding this bag with me and this name tag hanging on my neck. It has my name, where I'm coming from, and where I'm going. 1 out of every 10 immigrants that come to the United States does create a job for us. 100 immigrants that come to the United States, about 180 of them start up a business. So, am I an asset? Or am I an immigrant? Or am I me? I'm going to look into this situation a little bit in depth. There are a lot of myths out there that talk about immigrants coming to the United States, creating costs and increasing the welfare that's being supported to every other person who's not native. Yes, we do come here. Let's say let's stop immigration completely. What's going to happen? There's an accumulative of about $8.1 trillion in loss in GDP without immigrants. So am I an asset or am I an immigrant? If we say we're going to have immigrants come here, 3 million of them per year, there's going to be an increase of about 2.6 in GDP. Yes, immigrants do bring our economy to a healthy level. And yes, we're an asset. But I'm going to tell you to think a little about Plato's theory on human nature. No one is self-sufficient. No one. A society needs a society. A community needs a community. And yes, we left and abandoned our societies and community to come here. And today, I make this place my home. Am I an asset or am I an immigrant? My name is Emma Shekinah, and I'm going to ask you to look at immigration at a different angle, a humanitarian angle, where people come together and accept everybody else, not as an asset. So please, see me as me and not as an asset. Thank you.
My name is spelled L-E-A-H. And while my parents insist that it should be pronounced Leah, I will never not respond to Princess Leia instead. Now, I'm not a big Star Wars fan, but I do love my princesses. However, I feel that as I've gotten older, I relate less and less to these women. While I'd like to believe I can still sing just as beautifully as Princess Ariel, my roommates would probably disagree. And so, I believe it is time we make princesses great again. We need princesses who would represent college women across the country. First, we need a princess who falls for a frat guy her freshman year. I mean, come on, we've all been there. Brad from Beta Pi shoots you that look across the party, and before you know it, you're with him and his bros in a white Jeep listening to Mo Bamba in Sicko Mode on repeat. I would rather fight off the Hun with Mulan than ever have to experience that again. Next, we need a princess who oversleeps and misses her 9 a.m. class for the 12th time because she was up too late watching The Bachelor. I used to admire Princess Belle because she was so smart and educated, but at this point, I just think she's showing off. Finally, we need a princess who wears leggings and her hair in a ponytail. Between school, work, and most importantly, checking my Instagram feed every 5 minutes, I don't have time to be prancing around in a ball gown. In conclusion, the old Disney princesses are overrated. We need new women who would represent the interests of our future female leaders. And though I'm no expert, I will say, Princess Leia doesn't sound like a bad start at all.
Good afternoon, my name is Jesus Jimenez, and this is called Thank You. Thank you, Mom and Dad, for all the choices you've made in your life, because without those, I wouldn't be here today giving this speech. Thank you for walking 3,000 miles away from your life to give your family the life they deserved, a future here in the United States where you knew they could become anything they wanted, a nurse, a doctor, a scientist, maybe even president of the United States, who knows? Just look at what you've done so far. Your firstborn goes to the University of Utah, one of the greatest universities in the world. Your secondborn, she's about to finish high school. She has a little way to go. And your thirdborn, well, she just started elementary, but she has an even longer way to go. But at least she has the foundation you wanted to set for her. Well, yes, we have hardships. For example, money's a problem. You don't know English sometimes, so I have to translate for you. I've had to help you in every single shape or form. But this wouldn't be the same here and in any other country. And no, this isn't a remorse, a regret, why did you do this to me? This is a thank you. This is a thank you, because without you guys choosing to leave all of your life behind, I wouldn't have this passion, this desire to pay back all of your sacrifices. This is why I'm going to school. This is why I encourage my sisters to go to school, because we need to pay back everything you did for us. Now, with this in mind, I'll be able to say like Dad once said when he was dying and on the hospital, and they asked him, why do you work so hard? You're dying, you're sick, you're tired. Well, I can say the same thing now, because the future of my family depends on what I do here today. Thank you.
Is it on? I can't tell. Okay, sorry. My name is Tina, and my piece is called I'm No Superhero. Turns out, I'm no superhero. Funny, right? We all believed when we were young that we were filled with some hidden superpowers, but really we're just filled with abundance of confidence. You felt like life is good and life made you fly with your cape of faith. Even when you tripped, leaving some scrapes on your skin, you still leaped to fly, and that was you being a superhero. But I'm no superhero. For when I was 18 years old, I flew with my mom's words, believing that I was strong, therefore I could conquer anything that comes my way and that I was a superhero. But when I turned 19 years old, the only thing that was proven to me was that it only takes one person to doubt your value of life. A few years ago, I got stuck. My cape got stuck not by a tree or by a closed door, but by a hand that didn't symbolize a warm touch, but a strong grip, a grip that held me so tightly not to keep me from getting lost or to comfort me, but to hold me down so he could use his other hand to beat me. It came to pass, in his words, that I must be so grateful for him, for look at me. I am battered, and no one wants that. No one wants me but him. So no, Mom, I am not strong. I really cannot conquer anything that comes my way, and I am no superhero. I feared for my life by an 18-year-old boy because I knew he was out to hurt me. He was out to get me even when he has loved me. His love abused me. His anger disturbed me. His words broke me. My own life drained me, and I am too tired to fight him. My superpowers and my confidence just left me, so how can I be a superhero? You see, those words, I thought they were true for a very long time. But they're not. This is the actual truth. I held on the whole time. I held on even when he tried to pull me back. I didn't move forward for a while, and that's okay. I held on until I got that 1% of confidence to walk out of that relationship, and now I am here. I am happy, and I am finally safe. So yeah, I guess my mom was right. I am a superhero.
I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. Oh God. I'm not good enough. I don't know about you, but I'm not sure if I've met someone who made it through junior high or adolescence without at some point being made to feel not good enough, not smart enough, not fit enough, not thin enough, not pretty enough, not attractive enough. At some point or another, we're all made to feel not good enough. We fuse to this thought as though it has value. We invest in it as though it becomes part of our identity. And I can't help but wonder, what if a thought was just a thought? What if an emotion was just an emotion? Let's test this out. I want to invite you to participate with me. Feel free just to repeat what you hear me saying. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. Okay, let's go ahead and whisper it now. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. Building's empty. We can go ahead and shout a little bit. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. Oh my gosh, let's think about little Kennedy. Say it like you're saying it to a little baby over there. Oh, I'm not good enough. No, 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 who's not good enough? I'm not good enough. No, 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 I'm not good enough. I'm confused. There's a discrepancy here. This thought, feeling not good enough, has been something that has defined many of our worst experiences, and yet I look around this room, and I see laughter, and I see smiling. We can diffuse, and I wonder, what if a thought was just a thought? And an emotion, just an emotion.
All right, I'm Alexis Koopman, and this is How to Be an Engineer.
Who was your role model as a child? Maybe Michelle Obama, Hannah Montana, Oprah. While incredible, none of these women are engineers. Maybe because being a woman in engineering means we don't get taken seriously. I'm more likely to be asked to take notes than to work on important research. Being a woman in engineering also means double standards. If I speak up against harassment, I'm called emotional and irrational. If I say nothing, the situation gets worse. Being a woman in engineering also means being seen as anything but an engineer. If I show an interest in art, psychology, or public speaking, I'm told to switch majors. If I'm frustrated with my courses rather than supported, I'm told I picked the wrong career. Being a woman in engineering also means isolation. I only know three other women who are computer engineers. One is my best friend. Sometimes we both don't know if we're good enough engineers. We don't know any upperclassmen who have done what we are doing. Still, being a woman in engineering is my dream. Even though I had to wait until I got to college to finally meet someone who shared that dream. A dream that being a woman in engineering meant I would do research. It meant I would meet phenomenal people. It meant I could overcome any frustration. And the girls in the engineering class I taught last summer don't feel alone. They have a role model, and it's me. So even though you don't take me seriously yet, I'm still here, and I'm an engineer. Thank you.
Once upon a time, in an enormous building atop a great hill, a woman in a gown and gloves ran down a long hall. But before I continue, I have to warn you, this is not the start of another Cinderella story. This is a different kind of fairy tale. For the building was University Hospital, and I ran down the halls of the operating room, racing to obtain blood for a critically injured victim of a motorcycle crash. My gown was made of lead and designed not to accentuate my curves, but reflect radiation. My gloves were disposable purple nitrate polymer. Can you see it? There I was, the worst dressed fairy tale heroine of all time. In a world riddled with violence and unkindness, it can be difficult to believe in fairy tales. In happy endings, and at times, in anything at all. But in it, I have learned to believe in people. And that's why I'm writing a different kind of fairy tale, where I choose to don a different gown and a different pair of gloves. Because for me, it's not about glitz and glam, but dignity and decency. I'm choosing a pathway of sweat over sparkles and blood over beads, because I hope it means that I can make a difference. This fairy tale doesn't come with a fairy godmother, but it does come with something magical. It's the ability to prioritize people above all else. And so she continued to run, to race, hoping only to impact a life. Through every gunshot wound, every suicide attempt, and sometimes down to a motorcyclist's last breath. She, like the rest of you, in your own unique ways, work to make a difference. And she did. Ever after, the end.
Hello, I'm Kristen Kessler. I have a question for you. Do you believe in magic?
Absolutely.
I do too. But it was a really long road to get to the point where I actually was able to believe in magic, because that's a little bit different than what everyone told me I should believe. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but your words? They construct me. I wear them like designer jeans. In sociology, the self-objectification theory implies that who I am has actually been written by all of you. You see, when I looked in the mirror, I saw the trauma. I saw the abuse. I saw the assault. I saw that fat girl. I saw losing sectionals by 0.2 seconds. But when I sat in my sociology class, and I heard this theory, I felt a rush of relief. Because it's time that not only I, but But all of us go home, or wherever it is you want to go, and look in the mirror and see you for who you are. You are beautiful. You are magnanimous. You are undeniably unique. And whenever you feel like you are a fish completely out of water, that means that you're in the right place. Because it's not conformity that causes greatness, but the ability to see your individualism as a unique trait to take over the world, to be kind humanitarians. So I plead with you. I plead with you to let go of the burdenous chains that others have latched to you. If you've ever been told you were not good enough, that you were fat, that you were not smart, let that go, because you will never be alone and you will always be correct if you have the ability to look in the mirror and see you for you. Because how can you be alone if you have yourself? Thank you.
One in five. What a chilling statistic. Yes, I'm referring to the number of American women that will be sexually assaulted at some point in their lives. Little did I know that I would become that one in five, and little did I know that it would be while I was traveling solo through Europe last summer. While I was in Rome, I found myself in a situation that I could not escape. My Airbnb host took advantage of me in the very room I was renting from him. Being intoxicated wasn't enough to stop him. Saying stop wasn't enough either. And after what felt like years of physically pushing him away, he did finally stop. But what was almost worse is when he stayed in my bed for 30 minutes afterwards, begging me to let him continue because I was making him feel bad about himself. The next day, I left Rome, and I filed a report with Airbnb, and I left a review on his page warning other women not to stay there. After that, a torrent of messages from him flooded my phone, Airbnb inbox, and even Facebook. One of the many said, "Avery, you know your reference is not true. You will ruin my business in this way. Can you please take it down?" Although I was very fortunate Airbnb took my report seriously, not everyone has the same experience. 75% of sexual assault cases go unreported, and the largest single reason, which is 20%, is due to a fear of retaliation. But what this experience taught me the most is that this is not just an American problem. In fact, the UN has deemed it the global pandemic. The Me Too movement started in America, but its message has resonated throughout the world. In France, it's Ballonstone Pork. In South America, Nina Menos. And in India, Me Too India. But from these movements, the question arises, what can we do now? I say, and now we keep fighting, not only for women in America, but for women around the world.
When I was 18 years old, I went on a date. Me and this girl sat down and started having coffee, and she was like, "Hey, Bryce, tell me about your family." I said, "Well, you see, my mom is the most amazing woman in the world because she raised me and my three other siblings on her own without a man in her life or a college education." She said, "Bryce, that's awesome, but what about your dad?" "Well, my dad died when I was 5. She grabbed my hand like this, and she said, "I'm so sorry to hear that. How did he pass?" Does anyone here understand how annoying that question is? Like, is it absolutely essential to your core being that you understand how the person who was genetically inclined to love me more than anyone else on the face of the planet died when I was 5? Like, trust me, if my father died from colon cancer, I would tell you how I was becoming a doctor so I could find the cure, but no, my father's way of death is the absolute taboo of death, the so-called coward's way out, which in my eyes is just about the most messed up thing you can say about someone who decided to end their own life, so don't you dare try to patronize my father when only 7 people have read his last 4 pages and you are not one of them. But I'm actually up here trying to defend my father's actions. It is so hard to defend suicide, because suicide is a permanent choice to a temporary problem that in my father's case looked like a 45 and it took less than half a second to discharge his consciousness into nothingness. And how am I supposed to tell somebody this? I am so helpless because I was sitting there on this date, so terrified to tell this girl what's actually going on in my mind, because I know if I tell her the truth, the conversation will escalate. And I'm gonna have to tell her that when I was 16 years old, I attempted to follow in my father's footsteps. She was holding my hand like this, and she said, "Bryce, I'm so sorry to hear that. How did he pass?" Well, you see, he had colon cancer, and we kind of just caught it too late. But I don't want to bring down this conversation. What's your favorite color? Blue? Hey, me too.
Hi, my name is Zach. As I was walking home from school one day, I heard a group of boys come up behind me. I realized who they were and immediately braced myself for their onslaught of insults. This time, they even shoved me to the ground for good measure. Once I stood back up and dusted my knees off, I decided that I had had enough. The next day, when I reported the incident to my fifth grade teacher, she squeezed my arm and gently said, "Zach, don't worry about them. Boys will be boys, right?" To say I was crushed would be an understatement. Much later, I was sexually assaulted. I didn't report it because I was tired of being told the same excuse I'd heard time and time again. Being told boys will be boys was far worse than suffering in silence. In recent years, we've taken significant steps in rectifying this abuse. The hashtag MeToo movement has given voices to survivors who have been forced into silence for far too long. But this is not enough. The root cause of boys being allowed, no, encouraged to act this way is because there are no real consequences. This is what enabled Brock Turner to serve only 3 months after pleading guilty to raping a woman. This is why Brett Kavanaugh sits on our Supreme Court. Boys will be boys has become a legitimate justification for rape, sexual assault, and other forms of violence. I'm sick of being told boys will be boys, because boys will not be boys. They will be whatever we teach them to be.
Hi, my name is Aisha Shadali, and my speech is called Islamophobia. What is one lesson that our parents taught all of us? Not to stare in public. Well, this man had forgotten the lesson his mother had taught him when he stared angrily at my Muslim friends and I. Yes, you see my skin. You see my hijab. Yes, you see my womanhood. It's hard not to stare. My identity is scrutinized on a daily basis, whether I'm a person of color, Muslim, or a woman, to a world that fails to normalize its diversity. The media has compared Islam to terrorism like apples are to oranges. Islamophobia is real. Our humanity and normality stripped from us. It's dirty looks in a Starbucks and being called a terrorist on social media. Humanity is afforded to those who are human, and I'm not human enough. My hijab makes me deserving of prejudice and discrimination for just existing. Growing up, I used to hide my identity because to live as a Muslim is to live with fear. A 3-year-old, amongst 49 other innocent victims, have died in a place of worship in New Zealand from another act of terrorism. A few weeks later, 150 Fulani Muslims have been killed in their villages in Mali. Acts of terrorism have shaken our world, and most of the world has done nothing for the safety of my people. It's not just stares and whispers, but the threat of blood leaking from my body that I fear. Terrorism has no religion, no face, and can't have a place here, but somehow it shows up and haunts people like me. So, what's another lesson that our parents have taught us? They taught us to love one another past our differences. Our differences have divided us, but our differences can also bring peace to this world. So I leave you with this message. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. And wa alaikum assalam. And on to you be peace. Thank you.
You and I are going to play a little game. So I'm going to start by giving you your instructions. The first thing I want you to do, locate the nearest rubber band, slip it onto your wrist, and then snap yourself as hard as you can with it. Once you've done that,
I want you to do it again. And again. And again. Until it hurts. Then I want you to take that paper and pen you got on the way in here and make a list of every single thing you hate about yourself. Frame it up like you are a problem to be solved. This game is called the shame game, and it's not fun and it's not effective, but it is the game that literal children are forced to play in conversion therapy. Even though the participants are young, I want you to make no mistake about this. This is a high stakes game. Individuals who are subjected to conversion therapy are 5 times more likely to attempt suicide. So this game goes one of two ways. Best case scenario, the player will spend the entire rest of their life just trying to pass go and move on. Worst case scenario, player removes himself from the board completely. This will continue to happen as long as this game is allowed to be played, and that is a long way to go because this is still legal in 35 states, including ours. I know that's a statistic I'm not proud of. I want to propose one new rule. Each of us in this room is going to hold the people in our lives to a standard of compassion. Tell your friend, tell your family member that what they said was ignorant and harmful. Tell your senator that you are depending on them to vote for the safety of these kids. Because when you take into account the sheer amount of damage that has already been done and the number of lives that are currently hanging in the balance, it is very clear that the time for games is over.
Hi. My name is Rachel Carlson, and this is called Institutionalized. I stand here today registered as a student, and because of my presence, you perceive me as prudent. If I showed you my grades, you'd attribute me with aim, but that facade is intended to conceal my shame. So let me tell you this, because you can assist. I have a mental illness, and often it's missed. Teachers, administrators, hear me when I speak. The problem I have is not one that's unique. When I show up late to your classes, it's not because my feet are soaked in molasses. My illness harasses, berates, and abuses, and I don't get to pick the days that it chooses. When I can't turn in an assignment I wrote, this institution requires a doctor's note, but I don't have health insurance. So there's no access to simple procurements. It's not as benign as showing up to the test. When I fought a battle just to get dressed, now I'm at the exam and I can't focus on questions because the counseling center is limited in sessions when I'm panicked in class and feel like I can't breathe. Why is my only option to leave? I tell you this not just to make you agree. I want you to understand me and to know my plea. It's time we get serious about mental illness. You all in positions of power can help me fulfill this. I left this school and went to a psych ward because I felt that all was lost and I had nothing to look toward. What brought me back here was not the plan of a lesson. It was communal support that helped my symptoms to lessen. We are not doing enough. And to think that we are is more than a bluff. Stigma is systemic, ingrained, and pervasive, and to ignore this issue is more than evasive. The program for students in crisis is called REACT, which means that we teach response to trauma after the fact. I don't want to positively lament. I want to have a conversation about how to prevent. Now is when we change our thoughts and priorities. My plea is to those of you with authority. It takes more than me standing on a stage. It requires all of you to feel my outrage. So when will you stand up and be my ally? So students like me are not alone when they cry. Though my illness that imbues me with shame is loud, I stand here today mentally ill and proud.